Glenn Beck.
Be consistent, tell the truth, and be authentic. That's all that Americans want from the media. Those three things. Surprisingly, last week, the New York Times delivered on that. They ran a bombshell feature story about Harvey Weinstein's long history of sexually harassing female employees, aspiring actresses, and just about anybody, including a plant at a restaurant. It's sick. You've probably seen his name about on 50% of the movies that you've watched in your lifetime. He is the movie producer behind Best Picture Oscar movies like Shakespeare in Love and The King's Speech. The New York Times reported that he paid off at least 8 women to keep them from talking about his really super creepy, sleazy ways that he did business. Yesterday, last night, his company board of directors fired him. So kudos to the New York Times for running the story. Couldn't have been an easy decision. Weinstein moves in the same liberal elite circles as many of the other media honchos in New York City. He even hosted a fundraiser for Hillary Clinton in his home last year. She had turned her campaign into a referendum on Donald Trump's treatment of women. It must have been a little uncomfortable, even though she gladly accepted the campaign funds from the guy who was mistreating women for decades and everyone knew. You would think another New York media institution, Saturday Night Live, would have had a field day with this Saturday night, since they care so much about women's rights. And they hammered Donald Trump last year for that Access Hollywood tape. But instead, SNL decided to shelve all of the Weinstein jokes that they had prepared. Perhaps maybe it hit a little too close to home for somebody in Saturday Night Live. It couldn't have been NBC, because today Megyn Kelly had one of his accusers on her new show.
I know he called you the next day at your TV station. That was, didn't have your phone number. That's what you say. And how did that go?
That was so crazy, because the next day after I fled, basically, he called my station. They said, I have Harvey Weinstein on the line for you. And my heart sank. And he said, I just want to let you know, I had a great time last night. Excuse me? Yeah, I had a great time last night. I'm going away overseas on a trip. I would love to see you again, if that's something we could do. I said, absolutely not. I told you yesterday, I have a very serious boyfriend. Absolutely not. And I'm pretty sure I just hung up the phone quickly after. It was a very short conversation, but that was the most shocking part.
Okay, so now here we find ourselves in a place that I hope we can find that sweet spot between a witch hunt and the truth as we move forward. But these things tend to move into the witch hunt quickly. Whatever the case is here, just know one thing. Last night, the Weinstein Company, the board of directors, did not fire him because they found out. They fired him because you found out.
It's Monday, October 9th. You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
Joining us in studio, an author, radio host, commentator, extravaganza. It's the author of Martin Luther, The Man Who Rediscovered God and Changed the World, Eric Metaxas.
Good friend. I haven't seen you been a while. Since I think I left New York.
I think possibly.
How are you?
I may have seen you in Florida at some event. It is great to see you. I love you and admire you from a distance.
Well,
but
likewise.
Now from a very short distance. Yeah. Glenn, thanks for having me.
Yeah, good to see you. Your book, Bonhoeffer, it just changed me, fundamentally changed me. And you have made a career out of going in and highlighting these really amazing people that stood at critical times. You did Bonhoeffer, Wilberforce,
yeah.
And now Martin Luther.
Yep.
Martin Luther seems distant and dusty. Dust him off.
You obviously haven't read the book, Glenn.
I have not. I just got it today.
This book will blow the cobwebs off any dusty recollections you have. I have to say, in all seriousness, as it is with every one of the books I've written, it wasn't my idea. I kind of didn't want to write it. You know, Bonhoeffer, you know the story. Mm-hmm. Writing Bonhoeffer was tremendously painful and difficult for me. I had to switch publishers. It was an agony of my life. People think I'm exaggerating. It was hell. But God spoke to me and he said, I have my hand on this book. And he did. But I really wasn't gung-ho to write another biography, I'll be honest with you. But some friends, I dedicate the book to them, twisted my arm and kept saying, Eric, you wrote the Bonhoeffer book. You're the guy to write the Luther book because it's the 500th anniversary. And I actually thought, well, what 500th anniversary? I'm not, you know, paying attention.
Right.
And they explained to me 1517 is the moment when he nailed the 95 Theses to the door of the Wittenberg Castle Church. And that's where they trace the beginning of the Reformation, was this moment. Although, you know, talk about blowing the cobwebs off of things. We see that moment in retrospect as a heroic moment, right? He's thundering against the corrupt papacy by nailing this thing. And it's just the opposite. He was like tacking something up to a bulletin board. It was like a notice. Hey, you know what? I think we're going to have a little debate, a theological debate.
Really?
Oh, yeah. No, if you read that part in the book, you won't even believe what it really was. In fact, not only was he not tacking something up on a bulletin board, he may have given it to the church custodian to tack it up on the bulletin board. Or he may have done it himself and used paste and not a hammer. Like, we have this image of him.
So what happened? So how did that get...
All right. Basically, I mean, to focus on that, this seminal moment 500 years ago, he was somebody who had discovered some things theologically. But let's get it straight. He was a humble, obedient monk. This was not a firebrand or a rebel of any stripe whatsoever. This was a man devoted to God and devoted to the church. And he saw that what was going on with indulgences, by the way, he was a priest. So people would come to him in the confessional and say, hey, I got to get out of jail free card. Here you go. And he would look at this piece of paper that they had bought with their money, which they didn't have. And he would say, what kind of corruption? What kind of confusion? These people's souls are in danger. They think they can spend money and sin and pay for it. I mean, it had become very corrupt. But he didn't say, oh, well, I'm going to tear the church down. He thought to himself, it is my duty as a theologian, because he was not just a monk and a priest, but a fine theologian, one of the finest. He said, I need to bring this to the attention to the academic establishment, to other theologians, because if we don't begin to deal with this issue of indulgences, it's going to bring us down. This is one of the most terrible excesses that we've experienced. And so he said, let's have an academic debate. So in Latin, he prints up 95 statements, which when you wanted to have an academic disputation, that was kind of the way you did it. And you tacked it up someplace and people would say, oh, that's interesting. I'd like to participate. And you'd gather and have an academic debate, maybe in Latin, probably in Latin. And so he tacks this up, having no clue that in retrospect, it will look like, you know, Neil Armstrong planting the flag on the moon, Columbus planting the flag in the American soil. I mean, it's a moment in history that has grown out of all proportion, because in retrospect, we understand the significance of that moment led to everything that followed.
That is bizarre, because it is, you do look at that as a moment of courage. When did the moment of courage hit him?
Well, I would say that there are, as with anybody of true courage and faith, there it's a continuum of courage. In other words, it's not like at mm-hmm. one moment he girds his loins and says,
right. I mean,
he was a man who, what I talk about is that before this moment, when he had become a monk, for example, why did he become a monk? He became a monk because he took the idea of salvation and heaven and hell so seriously that he said, I need to devote my whole life to this. And this was against his father's wishes. His father had sent him to the finest schools, wanted him to become a lawyer. And just as he begins law school, it all kind of gets to him. This is in 1505. He's 22 years old, and he kind of realizes, I don't know where I'm going to spend eternity. Some lawyers had just died and had shared on their deathbeds that I wish I'd become a monk. Where am I going now? He was rattled. I think a lot of people were rattled, but he was a very intense, passionate person, brilliant. So he decides in a moment, that's its own story, that he's in the middle of a lightning storm and he fears for his life. And he blurts out to St. Anne, who is the patron saint of miners. His father was in the mining business. He says, St. Anne, if you save me, I'll become a monk. But it wasn't like he just blurted it out and hadn't been thinking about this. Let's mm-hmm. face it, he'd been thinking about this for years. So he becomes a monk and then devotes his life in the monastery to praying harder, to confessing more, to fasting more. He was skin and bones. I mean, the whole experience was, how do I earn my way to heaven?
He must have hated the popes.
Well, no. Not until later. This is what's
Who was before Leo? Because Leo the 10th, right? And the one before him was also like
was it
nasty.
Sixtus? I forget. Yeah. Look, these dudes, they were, I mean, every educated, devoted Catholic is properly ashamed of this period of the papacy. It's like the church, I mean, since, and people know that I'm a very pro-Catholic, non-Catholic. I didn't write this book to bash the Catholic Church. But when you look at this history, you see what is the tendency, and this all goes back to what we believe about freedom and the nature of man. What is the nature of any institution, the nature of power? It's to consolidate more power. How can I get more power? And the church had become hugely powerful. So Luther, while he's a monk, he's not thinking about this. He is a devoted monk. He's thinking about his own salvation. All that other stuff comes later. But at this point, he's devoted to saving himself in a way, right? And a lot of people think that's what Christianity is. You save yourself. You work hard. You don't sin. You keep your nose clean. You don't screw it up and you might get into heaven. And so he is working the program, right, to use a 12 steps reference, harder than anyone who's ever lived. And he's becoming more miserable. He's not getting closer to God. And so he starts cracking up. Why, if I am doing everything right. He would confess. At one point, he confessed 6 hours straight. His father confessor, Staupitz, who's in the book, literally says to him at some point, enough, bring me adultery, bring me murder, otherwise get out, leave me alone. You're torturing me. He would confess a moment of pride. I prayed so hard that I had a moment of pride for having prayed so hard, and I have to confess my pride. I mean, he was driving everybody insane. So long story short, Luther kind of realizes this is not working. I'm not getting closer to God. Do I love God? No, I hate God. God is a judge who scares me, and I'm trying to jump through these hoops to please him. And his father confessor, Staupitz, says to him, you don't think that God loves you. You think that God hates you, but he loves you. I mean, it was this real conundrum. So Luther eventually realizes that nobody is studying the scriptures, because as you know, the printing press wasn't invented until very recently at that point. And so Luther does what no one else is doing. Almost no one else. He starts digging into the scriptures. And I think of it like a guy who has a disease, and he says, I have to find the cure to the disease. So I don't want food. I don't want phone calls. I'm just going to be looking into the scriptures because I'm trying to find the key to my problem. And so he effectively finds it around 1517. All these things coalesce, and he realizes, oh my goodness, it's kind of like somebody tells you that, you know, you're racing up a ladder and it's like the ladder's leaning against the wrong building. You can come down now. You've been wasting your time. He says, what I've been looking for is given to me freely by God as a gift of grace. The righteousness of God, which I was scared of, is God gives that to me as a loving gift. I don't need to do anything. He gave it to me. It's in an account in my name. All I have to do is go get it. But nobody told me that it was there. It's like, you want to talk about a mind blower? This blew the mind of Luther. But then this is kind of like the bomb that the explosion from this creates the future in which we live. Freedom, everything that we take for granted in the modern world comes from that.
And we'll get into that here in a second.
Glenn Beck.
I am so thrilled to have Eric Metaxas not only on the show but in studio with us. He wrote a game-changing book for me called Bonhoeffer. If you haven't read that, you need to. And I just last week finished some books, and I thought, I am only going to start reading stuff that will fill me up with good, solid, rock-solid information. So this couldn't come at a better time for me. Martin Luther is his latest book, The Man Who Rediscovered God and Changed the World. So tell me how he's relatable today.
This is the funny thing. I mean, I take kind of a perverse pride in going into these book projects pretty darn ignorant. And I have friends, the guys I dedicated the book to, Marcus Speaker, and my buddy Greg Thornbury, the president of the King's College in New York City, was explaining to me, because he's a theologian, why I need to write the book, because Luther is significant in all these ways. And I, the more I went into it, the more I thought, how do we not all know this? And it happens with every one of these books I write. How did I not know this? And Luther, what he did exactly 500 years ago, opened the door to the future. I titled the epilogue, where I kind of explain all this in the book, The Man Who Discovered the Future, because this seminal moment, after 15 years of neglect, in a way, you could say, that the tradition, the accretions of tradition and so on and so forth, had obscured this central issue, which is called the gospel, the free gift of Jesus, which makes us all be able to have a direct relationship mm-hmm. to God. It doesn't need to be through an institution mm-hmm. or whatever. It's exactly what Whitfield was preaching, 200 years later, which created America. Without that, you don't have anything like freedom, the freedom of the individual to stand against the state.
It's crazy. Last week or 2 weeks ago, we had two people in the media, one Meet the Press, another one on NBC, that said that, your rights don't come from God.
I talked, somebody interviewed me recently about what Margaret Feinstein said and whatever. I mean, things are so bad that our leaders in the Senate, on the Senate level, do not understand the basics. It's like trying to write a book and you don't know the alphabet. They mm-hmm. don't understand the concept of what freedom is, where it comes from, that it comes from God, that at the heart of freedom is religious liberty, is this idea that I can think any dumb thought I want and it's protected. God says you have the right to think your own thoughts. It's so fundamental, but as you know, for 40 or so years, we've not been teaching this in the schools, so that even our elite journalists and our senators don't understand the building blocks of how we have everything that we have. And this issue of having a direct relationship to God, being all equal before God. I mean, when Whitfield preached this throughout the 18th century, up and down the 13 colonies, it was a revolution. People thought, really? You mean... If the minister is preaching something that's not right, I have the right to go to another church or to object? Or if the magistrate or the governor or the king is behaving in a way that's not right according to God, I have the right to protest or something? This was an earth-shattering thing, and it began for sure with Luther. And as we know, freedom comes with a price, right? Freedom mm-hmm. is not always good, in the sense that you are now free to do the wrong thing, mm-hmm. okay? You're free to start a crazy church. You're free to start the Church of Scientology, right. Not just a good Protestant church. You're free to start loony stuff and cults.
I have 30 seconds.
That's the price of freedom. But which of us would trade that freedom for the slavery of being under an institution that's going to tell you the meaning of truth and you cannot dissent?
I think more and more people are getting to that point, to where they're willing to do that. They're willing to trade but they take their freedoms so for granted. They don't even really understand it. They won't until they lose it. The name of the book is Martin Luther, the man who rediscovered God and changed the world. Eric Metaxas, the best-selling author of Bonhoeffer. Always good to have you in, Eric.
My joy. Thanks, Glenn.
God bless.
Appreciate it.
Glenn Beck. Program.
Well, Pat Gray is with us. Happy Indigenous Peoples Day, Pat.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It's a beautiful day.
It's a beautiful day.
Beautiful day.
And I know that you went out and you celebrated Indigenous Peoples Day this weekend.
Well, we had a huge weekend in preparation for Indigenous Peoples Day.
Yeah, what did you
Well, we went to San Antonio, but on the way we stopped off at Waco. At Chip and Joanna's Fixer Upper Place.
Yeah.
Have you guys been to the Silos?
I have, yes.
I have not.
You haven't been?
No, my wife has been, and she raves about it. And
It's pretty awesome. I mean, she had quite a vision. And there are literally hundreds of people on the premises.
It's incredible.
Hundreds. No. It's a fixer-upper show. They sell knickknacks. Why are you people here?
And they're
and
really
yet
cheap
we were
too.
There too.
You
so
like them.
You
so
like
much.
Them a lot.
Like
and that's what Jackie so kept saying. It's them. It's not the show.
Yeah, it is.
And I know it is, but it's an amazing situation they've created there. They have the business and the silos and the bakery, and then on the side they put out this AstroTurf.
Oh, yeah.
Where the kids can play soccer and football.
Well, and more importantly, it's surrounded by food trucks. Yes. That's
completely
that's the real...
surround the place. Yeah. And so they've created more business for the businesses in the city. And they created this trolley run from downtown to their business that's free. And so I mean, I don't know how many businesses have spun off theirs, but it's pretty outrageous.
The town must be freaked that they've said this is the last season.
Have to be.
Well, can you imagine the factories for facial cream that are going to be popping up?
Well, that's the thing. Yeah. Before we left, we had to buy some of her facial cream.
Yeah, the facial cream, it did not happen. I don't know if you know that, but it didn't happen.
We did go to the bakery. It was probably an hour and 15 minutes waiting in line, because the line stretches through the store, out the door, around the store, down the block. And
shut up.
It's incredible. I want to. And it's good. You know, they're good baked items.
Yeah. The stuff I had was
really
good.
It should be.
Yeah.
Yes, it should.
I mean, if it's an hour and a half to wait to get stupid cookie.
I know. It's like I've been in shorter lines at Disney World, and there was no ride once I got inside, except from the frosting on the cake. I think that took me on a buzz for a while. But it's astounding what they've created there. It's really astounding. It reminded me, I told Jackie, this reminds me of what Glenn was thinking for the
Independence. Yeah.
That's kind of what they're doing.
Yeah. And it's, you know, what's really amazing is they took this, they took a town that you used to say Waco.
Branch Davidians.
Yeah. You'd only think of the Branch Davidians. Now it's Chip and Joanna. I mean,
yes, they completely repositioned
the entire town.
Yeah.
And now you hear people all the time say, I remember when we moved down here, people were like, you should move to Waco. I'm not moving to Waco. What are you, crazy?
Yeah.
You know, that's and remember, we talked about it at some point. About it and said, can you imagine if we would move our studios to Waco, what people would say?
That's right.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
And now here, Chip and Joanna.
And they fixed it.
They fixed it.
I mean, Fixer Upper applies to the whole city of Waco. They have fixed it. Mm. They really have. Because
is there more to do in Waco than just Chip and Joanna?
Yeah.
No. There's a Dr. Pepper museum.
Okay.
That I went to.
Well, Stu has a little more knowledge on that.
I did.
We missed the Dr. Pepper museum.
Oh yeah. No, it was very cool. They had a Dr. Pepper, and that's where I went in. And they have whoever the Dr. Pepper guy was.
Dr. Pepper.
It's not. No, his name is not actually Dr. Pepper. It's something else. But the guy who started the museum was like a huge like free market guy, and they have a whole section of the museum called like the Free Market Center at the top of the museum. It's actually pretty cool.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah,
yeah.
And they have a lot of shops and stuff around there that have popped up. Some
and
of them.
And Baylor's there.
Waco.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So there's definitely stuff there.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, soda and baked goods are the main.
Yeah,
attraction.
It's mostly Chip and Joanna. Mm-hmm. It's their town now. They should rename it Chip and Joannaville.
It's an innovative name, Chip and Joannaville.
Wonder what their life is like in a town that small.
It's not that small, though, really. I mean, it's, you know.
What, 200, maybe 1,000 in the metro area?
But it's still a pretty small town to be that huge.
Yeah.
With the thousands, maybe hundreds, I would say between 500 and 1,000 people were there on the premises. If they showed up, I mean, it would be, I don't think they can. I don't think they can go into their own store. I don't know how they would. It would be bedlam.
What you need to do is leak. You get in line at the bakery and then leap if they show up on the other side of the premises.
Hey, they're over there.
Over there. Go see them. Oh, my God. They're here. And then you get all the cookies you want.
She's got her face cream right now. She's selling it right now in the parking lot.
So it is Indigenous Peoples Day, of course, as we
always known as Columbus Day.
Columbus Day. Mm-hmm. Pat Gray Unleashed is coming up on the Blaze Radio TV networks with David Barton today. Kind of going through the truth here.
I just want to find the truth. I just want the truth. If Christopher Columbus was, in fact, a genocidal maniac, let's get it out there. Let's go ahead and talk about it.
He is deeply conflicted. He is deeply conflicted. There is a great book called The Light and the Glory. Have you ever read this?
I haven't.
Oh, you should. Written by Peter Marshall. He was a professor of something at Yale. And he wrote this is the history of the founding of America. And he starts with Columbus. And the story of Columbus, it is so well written. It is, I mean, it's written like a thriller. And the story of Columbus are the first three chapters in it. And he goes from a good guy to a bad guy. I mean, there's times where he is really a good guy who's on a quest for, you know, for Christ and is humble.
That's absolutely how he started.
Yeah. And then he keeps getting sucked into the gold madness. And, you know, I know, Pat, you and I both believe that this land is sacred and it was preserved for this time and for these rites to come forth. And every time somebody is on, you know, gold fever, they never get here or they're destroyed. And he was destroyed in the end. And it's because God keeps trying to pull him back on track and he keeps going off.
His thing, though, was, and I don't know how much it stayed that way, but his thing was he's going to bring back riches for the glory of God.
He was trying to find Solomon's gold. He was trying to find Solomon's mines. Okay. And what he was going to do is bring it back. So then Queen Isabella and Ferdinand could then go take those riches and rebuild Solomon's temple. Mm-hmm. That's what he was going to do. Mm-hmm. So the gift for God was go find the gold to bring it back to rebuild the temple and be the reason the temple was rebuilt.
But none of that is discussed anymore. And these kids who go through college, the first day of my 17-year-old daughter's college experience, she came home and said, "Dad, my teacher taught me that Christopher Columbus is a genocidal rapist murderer who started the Western slave trade." I'm like,
well, at least you made it through a couple hours.
In some ways, some of that is true.
Not really, though. He had to respond to the murder of his men.
Okay.
His crew was killed, and then he got a little pissed.
Yeah. So hang on. So he leaves. He leaves the 38 men behind, and he leaves. He comes back like a year or so later. And they're all dead. And they say, through the translators that he had with him, they say, well, they were raping and pillaging. They wouldn't take no for an answer on the gold. And they just started having their way with any of the women that they wanted. And so we had to kill them all. And so the trouble starts there. And he had nothing to do with that. But then he had to decide, right, who do I believe?
Yes.
And that's where the trouble that's where the trouble started.
Plus, I mean, these tribes, one of the tribes he was very close to.
Yes.
Got along with really well.
Really well.
The cannibal tribe, not so much. They seem to have somewhat of a conflict because he had flesh and they wanted to eat it.
That's
where there was a little bit of a dichotomy and a little separation between the tribes.
Well, sometimes when they're hungry, you might have a disagreement.
They
with
were
the
looking
cannibal
at
tribe
him like he was a steak, and so he eventually had to wipe them out. I mean, I don't know if he had to, but he did.
Yeah.
He wiped them out.
Well, the population was 300,000. He reduced it by 100,000 in the end.
But that's not genocide, still were people.
No, it is genocide. I actually heard a guy talking about Indigenous Peoples Day legitimately. They're changing this in cities from Columbus Day.
They've already done it in Los Angeles. It's already Indigenous Peoples.
And I think
peoples.
It was the guy in Los Angeles talking about this, and he said, Columbus was responsible for the worst genocide in world history.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, I mean, 60 million people died in communist China.
Right.
I mean, the Nazis. You got Pol Pot. You got
Stalin.
Stalin. You got
Rwanda.
Well,
here's what kills me, too, is that they make this about a white guy. Even if you're right about Columbus, it was his Hispanic crew that did it all. He left. Yeah. He left as friends. He comes back and it's all
and
the
it's
Spaniards. Yeah, that were killing. So it wasn't the white man that did it. It wasn't the guy from Italy. He was fine with him. He had a good time. He went home. It was the Hispanics that did it. So
typical, he's going to the racism again, Pat. You seen this?
No, but I mean, I just want to point out. Let's be
unbelievable.
Let's be honest about it.
Yeah.
Are you amazed by what you're seeing though on, you know, Twitter and all this stuff?
I just can't even. I can't believe it. It is. The Q Allen writes, in honor of Columbus Day, take this tweet, put your own name on it, then erase mine. The next tweet, you've got to hand it to Christopher Columbus because he would have definitely taken it anyway and then murdered you. Me, this is mine. I discovered it. Them, what? No. Me, stab them. Columbus Day rules. Cop. Dang, he's right. I mean.
Incredible.
Happy this dude came over and pointed out what was already here day. As a man, I honor Christopher Columbus every day of the year by refusing to ask for directions. In 1492, Columbus was a genocidal piece of ass and an a-hole, too. I mean, it just doesn't. The only decent thing in the whole tweet storm is the only thing Christopher Columbus ever discovered was Daniel Radcliffe. See, that's the director. You
know, so here's the
similar name.
Here's the question that everybody has to ask themselves. Would you have been any different?
Yes, I would have done everything perfectly. I don't know about you guys, but yeah, I would have actually nailed it.
You're in front of the king and queen, and they say, you know, 10% of all the riches are all yours. You go out, you're on a ship, you're full of a ship of sailors who want to kill you, by the way. They want to kill you. I don't know if you know this, but the sailors back then are not like the U.S. Navy. So they all want to kill you. You've only kept them together because you've promised them the riches when they get to the land.
Right.
You get to the land, you are friendly with everybody, you turn around, they kill everybody, they start to kill everybody, they end up being dead themselves, you come back, there's all kinds of gold there, everybody has filled your head with you're the greatest guy ever, you're going to change the entire world, you're doing it for God, nobody is a no man to you, everyone is your yes man, because you are now the most powerful person on the planet.
Donald Trump to the 100th power.
You really think you're going to have the strength to be the one guy with all the sailors who just want the gold, the riches, and the raping? You're going to be the one guy all by yourself going, now, wait a minute, guys. Hold on just a second. I don't think so.
Glenn Beck.
So a few things that we have not had a chance to talk about. One is this event that happened in a bakery up in Seattle last weekend. That we have to get somebody on from the Liberty Council or someplace to find out, can these Christians sue the gay bakery for kicking them out? They should be able to. Hopefully, they would lose that lawsuit. Because then it would make it okay, right, to own your own store conscience. And be able to say, I don't want these people here.
Your own artistic performance you're allowed to own. I think that's...
I mean, it's pretty remarkable. Pretty remarkable.
I noticed, too, you've pretty much, you know, put the kibosh on the truth, as usual, is what you're doing here.
What truth?
Well, the truth about the shooting in Vegas. That it had to do a lot with O.J. Simpson, and Alex Jones uncovered it, and you won't play the audio. I want people to know that I've been trying all
day. I want the O.J. Simpson theory tomorrow.
Glenn Beck.